As I said yesterday morning, it was just a week to the hour from the time I left home till I stepped aboard a C-54 transport bound for the islands of the Pacific. I wish you could have been in on the briefing that preceded the beginning of that flight. We were shown a film illustrating the mechanics of ditching a C-54 in the event of trouble at sea. It was tremendously realistic, so much so that you were left no doubt of the seriousness of difficulties in flight far out over the Pacific. Step by step, from the development of motor trouble or other complications to actual rescue, the motion picture revealed a carefully thought-out procedure. We learned about the all-important Mae West, the handy rubberized vest that becomes a life preserver the minute it comes in contact with the water. Every passenger is issued one of these compact units and given special training in understanding its working parts and what to do with it in the case of certain possible emergencies. It all sounded very grim, so no one hesitated a minute in absorbing every tiny detail. We were likewise shown the workings of the rubber rafts that open and inflate automatically when thrown into the sea. All kinds of useful, in fact, absolutely essential devices were pointed out as being a part of this magical package capable of carrying from 5 to 8 persons for long periods of time with comparative safety. There was a compact radio transmitting unit operated by the turn of a crank that we were assured would throw out an SOS that could be heard at great distances. With precise precision, we were shown the potential dangers, then the ways in which we could save ourselves in the event that it proved possible to bring the plane down to the water right side up and for long enough to have time to clear the ship with the equipment provided for survival at sea. Immediately after the briefing was finished, we were led out on the flight line to the gigantic plane that was to carry us across 2,400 miles of ocean to Hawaii. This was the first leg of our journey only. Then this first plane and its crew would be replaced by other planes and crews as we moved on deeper and deeper into the Pacific. It would be almost impossible to give you an account or an accurate description of the way I felt when I heard the door of that transport slam shut. In an instant, the engines began to start one at a time. Soon we were rolling into the position at the head of a runway that looked miles long, and at the end of it was the last contact with land that we would know for possibly 12 hours or more. There was no delay in the takeoff. Before there was time to think about too many things, we were airborne, and climbing as fast as one could expect 35 tons of weight to be hoisted to an altitude of 10,000 feet by the strength of 4 powerful engines. We took 2 great circles over the field in the adjoining bay before turning westward to the sea. All the time the plane was reaching for a cruising altitude that would be reasonably safe for shoreline departure. Soon the Golden Gate and Oakland Bay bridges were immediately below, then behind us as San Francisco gradually dropped from sight. For a time I just sat there in the early evening and thought, as the engine settled down to the work ahead and my ears and other senses gradually became accustomed to the changes in atmosphere and speed. The seats were wonderfully comfortable, and there were the bells along the ceiling that we had been told would ring sharply in the event of trouble. The sight of them prompted me to turn hurriedly to see if the rubber boots and the radio were aboard. They were, and I could feel myself relax just a little bit. The young soldier who was the steward aboard gave strict orders that there would be no smoking except in the crew compartment up front. One person at a time would be allowed access to this area. Not being a smoker, this detail didn't concern me. We were told that the lounge and the restroom at the rear would accommodate only one passenger at a time, since any sudden shifting of weight to the tail of the ship would change the flying characteristics and be undesirable. So after a while, we began to be at ease, and I began a few observations in which I think you might be interested. By the time we had been in the air 40 minutes, the coastline was just a whisper in the gray mist that dulled the view to the east. We seemed completely detached from everything tangible. Across the rolling ripples of the sea to the southward, the haze was a thick purple capped by the pink gold settled there by the setting sun. To the northward, an open sea had the look of a glazed plain, smooth and regular, except for the tiny white caps that lazily rumpled the water where such detail was close enough to the plane to be seen. Straight past the bullet-like hub of the outside motor on the right wing, the sun, a weary companion, was still able to welcome us with a beautiful farewell, one that lured us to a tomorrow that meant Hawaii and the Orient. Low clouds reflected a charming glow as the blue of the sea deepened. The sky seemed emptier than usual, and a thin crescent of a brand new moon hung high like the curled edge of a white pine shaving. The fall of twilight was heavy and fast to the south, so much so that the skyline was quickly squeezed out of sight. In a matter of minutes, the trailing edge of the left wing was lost in the blur of gathering dusk and a fading sea. Rolling along behind us as though to cover the wisps of our trail, night settled with a swiftness that was a sharp contrast to the reluctance of the sunset in the west. Straight away, the bow of the C-54 pushed on unafraid, sure, steady, and eagerly willing. Slowly but surely, variations of coral and deep rose fringed with sunset gold died in the west, and almost complete darkness crept in to cut us off from almost every visible thing. The plane gave no hint of concern. Her great hull slipped along with the drive of an arrow. Her completely synchronized engines hummed in perfect harmony. Gracefully, the taper of her wings bled off into the night. Inside the cabin was dark, except for the pinpoints of light that bore directly on the reading and writing of those aboard. Around the walls of the ship, dimmed circles marked the slowly disappearing lines of the plane's windows. The propeller arcs outside had ceased to be even a blur, tipped by the 6-inch gold band made by the painted ends of each blade. Only the hard lines of the leading edge of the right wing and engine mounts remained to prove that there was still dimensional contrast in this picture of sea, sky, and growing darkness without end. At last we were alone. The feeling of flight had passed as we moved along, suspended in an impenetrable darkness. It was a long time before I went to sleep. There were so many things about which thinking insisted on going on and on. Among them was the realization that this was the longest overwater flying hop in the world, that I was launched on a flight that few persons of my generation would ever have an opportunity to take. Before daylight the next morning, we were stirred awake by the flight steward, who told us we were nearing the islands. We strained our eyes for a look at the lights of Pearl Harbor, and before long we were rewarded. In another half hour, we were at Hickam Field, the area that was torn to shreds by the first Japanese attack on American soil. Today, that field is as clean as a whistle and hard at the work of reclaiming everything that has been lost to the enemy in the Pacific. I thought of the many boys I had known who at one time or another had been stationed at Hickam. One of them was Jimmy Samuels, who was a brilliant young flyer, lost his life in the islands in the very early stages of the war that has since stretched into months and years of agonized combat. I wished for time to make Honolulu the first major chapter in this Pacific adventure, but my orders read through to Manila. So we were but 3 hours in continuing on our way. As we took off in the clear air of a beautiful morning, I took a long and respectful look at Pearl Harbor, where the good ship Arizona took such an awful beating on that fateful December 7th so long ago. I remember the Oklahoma, the California, and the other ships that were sacrificed in that first day of the Pacific War. I wished for all of you that the men, many of them Arizonans, who died in that sneaking attack could be around for the victory that is growing out here. Instead, they sleep on, and we fight on. Tomorrow morning, I'll give you more of my flight to Manila, and then we'll be ready for the real business of my junket to the Pacific. I'm telling the story of the travel involved because to me it's important, and I feel certain that most of you would want to know how it was all accomplished and what happened along the way. Until next time, here is Fred McPherson.